So I want to tell you a little bit about this Poisson bracket formulation of dynamical theories, which gives us classical mechanics and quantum mechanics as special cases. Okay, so we're going to consider a dynamical system with coordinates or dynamical variables. I don't really know what the careful thing to call them is. So we have qi alpha and pj beta. So here, alpha and beta are elements of some space. So we have x, y, z, our Cartesian directions, for example. And I and j index number of the particle number. So we have n particles. Okay, we're going to consider some polynomial functions of these coordinates in time. F, G, H, of the coordinates and time t. Okay, we're going to restrict to polynomial functions. We can always imagine that these functions just have some Taylor series representation. So e.g., some Taylor expansion. Okay, so now we're going to define a bracket called the Poisson bracket. Which shares a lot of structure with the Lie bracket. So the Poisson bracket is going to be a kind of multiplication. So the Poisson bracket between F and G is going to be equal to H. So it's a kind of multiplication. It's a kind of non-associative multiplication. And it's going to satisfy certain conditions. The first condition we impose on the bracket is antisymmetry. Let me start with A. So this means that F bracket G is equal to minus G bracket F. The second property is linearity or distributivity. And this is the fact that if we have scalars A and B, AF plus BG bracket with H is equal to A of F bracket H plus B of G bracket H for scalars A and B. We want Leibniz's law, which is a product rule. So this is that FGH is equal to F G H plus G F H. And the third property is the Jacobi identity. So these are the only formal constraints on the bracket. Okay, now this should look familiar because these are all properties that the commutator satisfies. Okay, now we're going to look at defining a dynamical theory. Okay, we assume that our base coordinates or our primitive coordinates multiply to zero under this bracket unless they share the same indices. So unless it's the momentum associated with that position, they commute under the bracket. And we're going to assume an evolution law which is that the time derivative of some function is given by that function Poisson bracketed with a function h, which is going to be our energy function. Let me just use vector notation. Okay, now we need to assume one more piece of structure to get our theory. So choice option one. Remember that these F, G's, and H's are polynomial functions of our coordinates, and we haven't said anything about how the coordinates behave under multiplication. So let's assume that the coordinates are commutative. Okay, so if we assume commutativity under ordinary multiplication, okay, then we can find a representation of this bracket. Okay, so if we have commutativity under ordinary multiplication, then we get a representation of the bracket in terms of differential functions. Representation in terms of partial derivatives. Okay, so let me write this over here. So the representation we get is that the bracket of f and g can be realized as a sum over all alpha equals x, y, z, sum over all particles, I equals 1 to n, df by d qi alpha, dg by dpi alpha, minus df by dpi alpha, dg by dqi alpha. Oops, this is just a regular. Okay, this should look familiar to those of you who have studied classical mechanics. Okay, now let's apply this to our dynamical law. Do assumption 2. And we get df by dt is equal to df. Let's just choose one dimension for simplicity of illustration. Then you get df by dq, dh by dp, minus df by dp, dh by dq, plus f can depend explicitly on time. We also can apply the chain rule to get df by dt is equal to df by dq, dq by dt. Remember, our coordinates can be functions of time. Df by dp, dp by dt, plus df by dt, which is the explicit. So recall we have f is a function of q, which itself is a function of time, a function of p, which is a function of time, and f can be separately a function of time on its own. So that's this partial here. Thank you. Okay, so now we can equate these two, and what do we get? Hamilton's equations of motion, exactly. So equating these two, let me write it down the usual way. dq by dt is equal to dh by dp, and dp by dt is equal to minus dh by dq, which are Hamilton's equations of motion. Which of course imply Newton's laws. So that's how we get the classical mechanics of the individual coordinates describing some physical property, which has a position and a momentum. But now what's even more interesting than this is that we can also obtain from this and our postulates, instead of getting Hamilton's equations, we can derive Liouville's equation. So let rho equal rho of QPT be a probability density. Over Hamilton's equations of motion, over trajectories, or particles, obeying Hamilton's equations of motion, Okay, that means we have rho is non-negative, and it integrates. I'm switching to just one degree of freedom for ease of notation here. So it's a non-negative function because it's a probability density, and it integrates to one. Then we have our dynamical law from assumption two. We get that d rho by dt is equal to rho Poisson bracketed with this h, where h is the energy function, the energy function that drives Hamilton's equations of motion. So it's the Hamiltonian. And then it turns out, and this is a little bit of a subtle argument, it always makes me a little bit uneasy, but I think it's one of these things that's crystal clear. It just makes me personally uncomfortable. But you can deduce that d rho by dt is equal to zero. Okay, so this, the way to understand why this is true, there's an argument in Goldstein in chapter 10 or whatever chapter he talks about Liouville mechanics. The argument is this: you have a phase space and you have all these, you have some initial density of trajectories. So this is your phase space. And you have some density. Let's just make it a flat uniform surface. And then under time, this will evolve into some other shape, okay, with some structure. The idea is that Hamiltonian evolution, well, this part of the argument is fine. Hamiltonian evolution is a symplectic transformation, which means it preserves areas. So this area is conserved. Okay, so what that means is that, think of this as, we have some finite sampling. We have, you know, like 1,000 trajectories we can describe here. And the density, the 1,000 points, all evolve to be contained within an area of the same size. So what this means is that the number of systems or particles, the number of particles per unit volume is constant under the flow induced by Hamilton's equations of motion. So there's an analogy to this, which is when you deal with partial differential equations, if you have an incompressible fluid, if you put like an ink drop of the same density inside of water, and that ink drop will kind of distort as it flows under the flow. But if it's an incompressible fluid, the size of that ink dot and its mass won't change in time, but the shape will change. Okay, so this is what's happening here. So this statement is analogous to, this is a property of an incompressible fluid. Okay, so there's lots of ways to see that. I never really feel like I have this airtight argument for it, but I think it's obvious to other people, just not me, that this follows. I guess I never got comfortable with partial differential equations. So a consequence of this, which is a property of the symplectic evolution under Hamiltonian dynamics, is that we get the Liouville equation, which describes, so the Liouville equation is the following. It says, look, Liouville came along and said, look, I have Hamilton's equations of motion. I can describe how cannonballs will evolve in time under some forces, or how the moon will evolve in time under the forces of the sun and the earth. But now, in practice, I never know the precise coordinates of anything to infinite precision. I always, in practice, have some uncertainty. So what I really want to describe is how does my uncertainty about the coordinates of the system evolve in time? So this is my uncertainty about where the system is. And where does my uncertainty go? So I don't want to take the middle point. You know, the middle point might go to here, okay? So I'll say, okay, well, the system is here. That's where the middle point goes. Well, this is not to scale, I guess. The point is, what you really want to know is, if there's a set of possible locations of the particle, I want to know at some later time t, what is the new set of possible locations and momenta? So he was interested in describing how our uncertainty evolves in time, how our statistical knowledge evolves in time, if the underlying flow is Hamiltonian. And Liouville derived this equation, which we're now deriving via a more sophisticated method. So what we're doing is we're recovering Liouville's equation via this abstract formulation. Okay. So now we just made two assumptions. We made three assumptions. We assumed that we had a set of coordinates that had Poisson brackets as defined above. We assumed we had a dynamical law, which came out of nowhere. And then we assumed that our coordinates commuted. And under that assumption, we got Liouville's equation, which is essentially classical mechanics in full. So now instead of doing that, we're going to take assumptions one and two, but we're going to change assumption three. So now we're going to consider instead a scenario where the case where the coordinates don't commute, or dynamical, we call them dynamical variables. Oh, so I should mention that, so this argument is due to Dirac. Okay, so this is from Dirac. Dirac's textbook on quantum mechanics. He's the one that figured this out. Okay, so now the amazing thing, and I'll tell you the punchline now, because we're going to do some tedious algebra. The punchline is going to be this. If we assume that the operators do not, that the dynamical variables do not commute under their ordinary multiplication, so remember, we have two forms of multiplication. We have the bracket, which is a kind of multiplication, and then you have the ordinary multiplication of the variables. So now we're going to assume that the ordinary, that everything else is the same, but the ordinary multiplication is non-commutative. We're not going to say how it's not commutative. We're just going to assume it's not commutative. And then we're going to derive the commutator. And then from that, we're going to get essentially Schrodinger's equation in operator form, where operator refers to variables that don't commute. So we get basically quantum mechanics now. Okay, so now, so first of all, when the coordinates don't commute, this representation in terms of the differentials no longer works. Okay, so in this case, the representation of the bracket in terms of derivatives no longer applies. Okay, so what kind of representation can we have? So let's consider some combinations here. Let's consider functions F1, F2, G1, and G2. And we'll look at the bracket for F1, F2, G1, G2. And we apply, what are we applying here? The Jacobi identity. So we're just now, we're applying just the formal rules of the bracket, and we get F1, F2, G1, G2, plus F1, G1, G2, F2. And then we apply the rule again, and we get F1, G1. Notice it's important that the G1 is on the right of F1 because we're not commuting anymore. So the ordering matters. F2, G2, plus F1, F2, G1, G2, plus G1, F1, G2. I'm just expanding everything out rather tediously. Plus F1, G2, G1, F2. There's a typo in my notes. I have this as a 2, so I assume that's a 1. Wait a minute. I've lost my. Okay, you guys need to help me now. So here I've brought G1 out, and then I have to bring G2 out. And then on this expression, I bring G1 out. That leaves G2. This is G1, G2. There. Sorry. This is which one is this? This is Leibniz's law. I'm applying Leibniz's law. But we can also we can also change the order. We can change the order in which we apply Leibniz's law. Okay, so we can also express F1, F2, G1, G2. By taking G1 out first, so then we get G1, F1, F2, G2, plus F1, F2, G1, G2. And then we do it again, G1, F1, F2, G2, plus G1, F1, G2, F2, plus F1, F2, G1, G2, plus F1, G1, F2, G2. So we have that this quantity is equal to this, and this quantity is also equal to that, so we can equate them. We get that the cross terms cancel, and we get G1, F1, F2, G2, plus F1, G1, F2, G2, is equal to F1, G1, F2, G2, plus F1, G1, G2, F2, which implies that G1, F1 minus F1, G1 times F2, G2 is equal to minus F1, G1 F2, G2 minus G2F2. Okay, and this must be true for every choice of F1, F2, G1, and G2. Okay, so if we independently vary F1 and G1, this has to be true, which means that the functions of two alone, the two functions have to be equal in and of themselves. Okay, so this implies that for every F and G, we must have that the Poisson bracket of G and F is equal to, is proportional to GF minus FG. Okay, so we can define the commutator. We define an object called the commutator between F and G as FG minus GF, which only makes sense for non-commuting functions or variables. And then okay, so let's, so then we have that GF is equal to, let's call it alpha, the commutator of G and F, where alpha is a proportionality constant. Is an unknown, undetermined okay, so now we consider a function f and we apply our dynamical law 2 and we have df by dt is equal to alpha FH plus DF by DT. Okay, so we have, this is the Heisenberg equation of motion. For any observable F. Well, that is Heisenberg's equation of motion, basically. So I'll say, which is, if alpha is equal to 1 over IH bar, which is kind of empirically determined. Okay, so I don't know, I thought this was really neat the first time I saw it, so I thought you guys would enjoy seeing it. There's all kinds of interesting questions. You know, this dynamical law, where does it come from? It can probably be deduced from the space-time symmetries. So there's some really nice work. Like if you see Ballantyne's textbook, he reproduces an argument due to Jordan from the 1970s where he shows that if you take the Galilean symmetries of space-time, which includes, you know, rotations for angular momentum, and you have the momentum generates displacements in position, and so on. And we know we have a group structure for those transformations. So given two such transformations in succession, we can write down a transformation for the composite action. So, and you know, when there's a one parameter, it's a one parameter group, where the parameter is time t. When t equals 0, it's the identity, things like that. And you can use that to show that if you look for a unitary representation of that, then you get classical Liouville mechanics, which I should say about this here. Let me bring this back down. So we know, let me just put this as part of this. We know that Liouville's equation, this admits a description as unitary evolution on a Hilbert space. I mentioned this in a previous class. So when you have an equation of this form, it turns out you can represent it as a Hilbert space theory, and classical transformations, which are these this symplectic flow here, can be represented as a unitary operator, where the infinitesimal generator of that is this Liouvillean quantity, which is this Poisson bracket, which is understood as that differential equation over there, the partial differential equation, is the generator of displacements in time. And the probability densities can be represented as vectors in a Hilbert space. So we can do classical Liouville mechanics, which is describing states of incomplete knowledge about the properties of the system, as a theory where if the system is evolving and we don't interact with it, it evolves unitarily, which is continuous, linear, and deterministic evolution of the probability density. And then whenever we perform a measurement and we acquire new information about the system's properties, then that is represented by a collapse rule given by Bayes' rule, which is non-deterministic. It violates the unitary evolution, nonlinear, and so on. So all of those features of quantum mechanics, which you usually see for the first time in your quantum mechanics textbook, are actually features of classical mechanics when you're talking about the mechanics of states of incomplete knowledge. And so there's this profound parallel there, in that these formal properties of quantum mechanics are classical features of quantum mechanics. There's nothing new happening when we talk about unitary evolution of a state, as long as we understand the word state to mean state of incomplete knowledge. If you don't make that assumption, then the parallel breaks down. You lose it. And then these features of quantum mechanics seem special. So the question is, by identifying the components of quantum mechanics that are that appear in a more careful representation of classical mechanics, then we can isolate the features of quantum mechanics which don't fit into that paradigm. We set a higher bar for what constitutes a quantum phenomena, which then is a useful thing to understand. When can I see the unique features of quantum mechanics emerging? So that's called the this is called the Koopman formulation. Of classical mechanics. And what I was mentioning a minute ago was the fact that if you take the Galilean group and then you look at unitary representations of that Galilean group, you get classical mechanics, classical Liouville mechanics expressed in this Hilbert space picture. If you take what's called a projective representation, then you get quantum mechanics. So there's this, it's kind of not clear, why would you take one representation over the other? One gives you classical mechanics, one gives you quantum mechanics. And then what's really neat is that, and this was figured out by Mackey in the 1970s, if you take the Lorentz group as your space-time symmetry, and you take a unitary representation of the Lorentz group, I can't remember if it's the Lorentz group or the Poincaré group, which includes rotations, and then you take the non-relativistic limit. So in other words, we do the representation of the group as a Hilbert space theory, and then we take the non-relativistic limit of that Hilbert space theory, then we get quantum mechanics. So somehow there's kind of a non-commutativity between the question of, if I start with the Lorentz group and I take the non-relativistic limit and I get the Galilean group, and then I do a unitary representation, I get classical mechanics. If I start with the Lorentz group and then I do the representation theory first, you take a unitary representation of that, and then I take the non-relativistic limit, then I get quantum mechanics. So that to me is extremely intriguing. I kind of want to explore that in my future research, understand kind of all the facets of that, maybe that gives some inroads into understanding things more deeply about the differences between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics and how they tie in with relativity and so on. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
Is there any way to go from one picture to the other in terms of a parameter in terms of, say, alpha?
Okay, that's a very good question. So it's very common for people to think about the classical limit as corresponding to h bar going to zero. That's what you have in mind, right? Yeah, so I think that that yields a certain level of insight doing that. It's a very common approach. It ends up being a lot more subtle than that, though. It's not enough. I mean, h bar going to zero is kind of, h bar is a constant, as far as we know. So h bar going to zero is really shorthand for this idea that my dynamical system I'm describing has some action scale, you know, some angular momentum or some energy over some time. And what we mean is the action scale of the physical system is large compared to h bar, so that you can define an effective h bar, which is h bar renormalized by the action scale of your system, and that's what's going to zero. Yeah, I mean, that's one way. I don't think you get the full picture of classical mechanics from that approach, but it gives pieces of it. Yeah.
What's a projective representation?
Okay, good. I don't know if I can give you a precise definition off the top of my head, but it's remember that I can tell you what it is by analogy with the cases that I know. So if you take, if you take your Hilbert space of vectors, and we say quantum preparation procedures are represented by vectors in the Hilbert space, then we found that we had this U1 phase factor, e to the I alpha, which was physically irrelevant. It never showed up in any empirical predictions of the theory. So what you do is instead of associating the preparation with the vector, I'm going to associate the preparation with the projector in that Hilbert space. So I have some procedure P, which I want to model with a vector in the Hilbert space, but then I realize I have an extra freedom because e to the I alpha psi is equivalent to psi. So that's a regular Hilbert space representation. So a projective representation is I'll represent this preparation procedure P via a projector, which removes the overall phase. And it means I'm representing objects not by vectors of the Hilbert space, but by rays in the Hilbert space. So I don't care about the phase factor.
But the vectors are on the group in any sense, are they?
Right. So So I think the point is you define the action of the group on the set of projectors rather than on the vectors themselves. So I don't know if I can give a more precise answer. This is something I need to understand better. Yes?
On the left board of the bottom, I'm just confused with one step. Why does the equation above imply that the Poisson bracket is proportional to GF minus FG?
Here? Yeah. All right, let's look at that. So we have this equation must be true for any choice of F1 and F2, G1. So let's keep F2 and G2 fixed. Let's keep F1 and G1 fixed and vary F2 and G2, okay? So if F1 and G1 are fixed, then this is just some fixed function, and this is some fixed function. And how do you see this? The way I think about this, I don't know if this is the best way to think about it, but when you do separation of variables, if we could bring this commutator, if we could divide through by this, or if we say we divide through by this, so we divide by this, and then we get a function on the left that's just a function of F2, G2 divided by F2, G2 minus G2, F2, and on the right we get F1, G1 divided by this bracket. Then if we vary F1 and G1, because we're not varying F2 and G2, that means that this divided by this has to equal a constant. That's the only way that these can always be equal, is we're varying them independently. I guess the idea, so how do you see this? I guess the point is that if we vary them independently, this equality must always hold. So that means that they independently have to be equal. Things that are a function of the two coordinate alone have to be equal, which means that this quantity has to be proportional to this quantity. Does that help? I don't know. It's kind of intuitive for me. It's hard to see. Does anyone see a precise way to articulate this? Why this equality follows? I thought you guys were supposed to be really mathematical. What's the precise way when you have independently varying functions? All right, well, let me think about it. There must be some really concise way to make that point, but yes.
Can I, so if we look at rho in the classical picture, if we talk about quantum mechanics, can we replace that by the Wigner function?
Yeah, actually you can. So that's something I've worked on. So basically, if you take the Liouville equation and you replace it by the Wigner function, then this equation holds, except this. When you do the Wigner function is a linear transformation from density operators to real valued functions on this phase space. So you take the Liouville equation, wherever I wrote that, you take the quantum evolution equation, which, where did I not write it down? Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't write it down anywhere, but, oh, it's behind here. Okay, so we have d rho by dt is going to equal 1 over h bar. I don't know if this is plus or minus 1 here. So if we take the Wigner function approach, which is a linear transformation from density operators to real valued functions, it turns out you don't only have to transform, so rho goes to this Wigner function, which is a real valued function. H goes to the Wigner function representation of H, which is a real valued function. Notice that this is no longer satisfies it being non-negative, which is okay. But then here's the piece that is critical. The bracket has to be transformed as well. So then the bracket under the Wigner function map, the bracket goes to what's called the Moyal bracket. And the Moyal bracket is equal to the Poisson bracket plus this hierarchy of terms and powers of h bar, which looks something like this, d to the 2n plus 1 rho w by dq 2n plus 1 minus dh by dp to the 2n plus 1 minus the opposite term. And so you have all of these correction terms. And so you asked about the h-bar going to 0. So here in this case, it looks like you've got an h-bar in the numerator, which when this goes to 0, this term drops off and you recover the Poisson bracket. You recover the classical description, and you hope that the Wigner function is non-negative, so it's truly classical. The problem is, these derivatives of the Wigner function bring down powers of 1 over h bar. So actually, the limit h bar going to 0 is singular when you account for the factors of h bar that show up here. So that's why the question of taking h bar to 0 is very nuanced. There are scenarios where things blow up unless you approach the right way, approach the problem the right way. And the way to overcome that is to express everything in terms of observable quantities, classical expectation values over the Wigner function. And then those are well behaved. So that's one of the subtleties. Yeah?
I think I'd make this precise. If you divide by the Poisson bracket F1G1 on one side, and then
divide by the other on the other side.
And you'll see the left-hand side is a function of F1G1, so it has to be.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. The problem is I'm not sure if you're always allowed to divide. I mean, as long as it's not zero, I guess it's well-defined. So the fact that it's true for a set of cases excluding the zero case is probably enough. Is that clear? Yeah.
Is it the other way around? We should divide by this GF minus FG, because that's the object that we said does not commute anymore. And this is exactly the thing that we cannot divide when we use option one. Right? So we see that this is exactly the opposite side. You know, because we know what that thing is.
Well, if F and G are both Q, if they're both the same, if F is 3 times the position variable and G is 4 times the position variable, then they do commute. So then you're dividing by 0.
But then let's assume that they're different, right? So that they're the same. Then we can do this.
Yeah.
The opposite perspective from before, where we assume that they commute and we can go to that derivative representation, right?
Yeah.
So we don't have to divide by the Poisson bracket, which is something that we don't really know what it is.
You want to divide by this instead, which is a concrete. Yeah,
wait,
I agree.
So
it probably doesn't matter.
You get the ratio, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it really matters either way. But yeah, so the point is you can just, you know, divide through in some way so that you have functions of the one functions on the left, two functions on the right. If I keep the one functions constant and just vary the two functions, the only way that equality can continue to hold is if this is true. Anything else? No? Okay. Well, thanks for all the questions this term. It's fun teaching you guys, and I wish you the best in your academic careers.